Today's show comes to you thanks to Ofakind, an online shop for emerging design. For more information, visit ofakind.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Sue. When I'm not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. So that means I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with clients which include chefs, sommeliers, big brands, startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. I'm recording live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on this icky fall day that feels like the sky is spitting on you. So, go ahead, stay indoors and tuck into a cappuccino or a glass of vino or a Negroni, which, by the way, are dangerously easy to make at home during the day by yourself, while I share with you a low-key hangout I recorded with chef and TV personality Michael Chiarello on August 11th, 2014 in charming Yountville, Napa Valley, California. This is one of our word-of-mouth hashtag SF sessions in San Francisco in the Bay Area to talk to chefs, sommeliers, restaurateurs, and other food friends. He and I catch up at his restaurant, Bottega, and you'll have to pardon a couple of technical difficulties in the recording. It's a Monday before dinner service. So peaceful. Let's get to know Michael, the Renaissance man, chef, Emmy award-winning TV personality, author, vintner, sustainable farmer, purveyor of cookware and furniture and food, father, husband. What doesn't he do? So now for hashtag people we like.
No, in life, like just
the like my point of view.
Your POV on just download. I'm just gonna stop talking right now.
My point of view. My mid-century point of view.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I have no. I'm not allowed to ask how old you are, but
mid-century.
Okay. Cool.
Mid-century. back in school. Back in school in the business I fell in love with. You know, the restaurant business and the chef world has a lot of twists and turns up the mountain of your life, and oftentimes it'll take you off what a quest is. Sometimes it's business, it's family, it's running restaurants. There's lots of moving parts and all the other interruptions that happen. And so now I'm going through the quiet stage. We just opened a Spanish restaurant called Coqueto.
Congratulations, 3.5 stars.
Thank you.
Chronicle, right?
And that was the beginning of me going back to school of saying, okay, I know what I know. What do I don't know? Let me take a new cuisine and see if I can open that part of my brain that hasn't been open in a long time.
Yep.
Been doing Italian food since I was 24. And then been Italian my whole life. So the having been trained in classical food and doing Italian for the rest of all of these years, it's nice to be a student again. It was nice to say, I have no idea. It's nice to ask people a question that's from knowing nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
And being a part of a reemerging point of view.
Awesome.
So, and that's my POV today.
Okay, that's your POV today. But where did you come from immediately? Or what was your day like?
Oh, my day like today?
Yeah.
Okay, so we did that show.
Where did I come from today? Well, it was a late night in my little food lab at home. I have a test kitchen that I set up at home, and I tend to cook all night like the mad scientist. And so I'm going through this look at flavor and flavor extraction. This kind of a relaunch of some food technology stuff that I did early in my career, and looking at each of our core flavors and seeing if there are other ways for them to be expressed other than what we know. So I spent the night working through a bunch of different lotions and potions and infusions. finished about 5:30. Slept a couple of hours. We're thinning the vineyard now, so we're working through some verge programs with the grapes that we're pulling off this time of the year. Aberration, when they begin to change color. Went back and tightened up all my notes and pulled some stuff out of the circulator and did some straining. And now I'm back up here with you. Gathered up a bunch of new ingredients at a farm. We'll be working through the rest of these. I'm doing the cocktail menu changes. In the restaurant business, there you have to have three other relationships other than as a chef, other than just what you're doing food-wise. If your pastry chef's deeply important, oftentimes pastry can be fantastic but can come from a different point of view.
Right.
And your wine list can do the same thing, and your bar can do the same thing. The bar today, mixology today, is more like a bar chef than anything else.
Absolutely.
So having taking all I know from one side and putting it in through the bar program and making sure that the culture of our bars matches the culture of our food.
Mm-hmm.
So the chefs and them and our barkeeps are working together with similar technology
or just vibe and spirit and
to have this conversation that happens over here. Not no, but what we like to do is add some absinthe. It's always, it seems like it'd be like absinthe or chartreuse and some tincture, some bitter, or something overly sweeter, you know, as opposed to how would you look at this, chef, if you were making a patatas bravas as a cocktail. What do you think the primary and secondary flavors are? What are the tertiary flavors? Where do they stack? How do they? What's that? So the you know, when we're working on a dish, you have a primary thing, or what's the emotion of a dish, right? And so the first thing you have to do is make sure that the guest gets that emotion. It's the difference between taste and flavor, right? Taste just happens in your mouth. Flavors, the emotional, the intellectual relationship with a dish, an ingredient, something that will be the memory of that going forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to make sure that if you have a cocktail at one of my restaurants, that it's consistent with the rest of the emotion. Otherwise, you have somebody for a two-hour period, and you're trying to make a relationship with them, and it should be consistent. It should thread together like a storyline. So my job is to open and close the accordion of the flavors and the stories to make sure there's not too many, make sure it's not too heady.
Right.
To make sure there's syncopation in the menu, not just what the dish is, the wine list and the offering, the cocktails and the desserts, all of that comes together, of course, with service and aesthetic and something around you, where threads together into one cohesive
lovely
feeling, right?
Stay close, because after this commercial break, we will hear from Chef Chiarello about technology TV and a dream he had recently. This is Leyte Sue on Word of Mouth Heritage Radio Network.
Interested in emerging design? Check out Of a Kind, a site that sells the pieces and tells the stories of up-and-coming makers. The site has featured over 200 designers and offers limited edition pieces that you can't find anywhere else, along with studio tours, travel guides, and even recipes from the designers. To find out more, head to ofakind.com and sign up for the site's newsletter.
We'll get back with Chef Michael Chiarello for our hashtag SF Sessions on Word of Mouth Heritage Radio Network. We're hanging in his restaurant Bottega in Napa Valley on a Monday afternoon in August.
Fantastic. It's no different than anything else. Any other mode of transportation, right? You still need to enjoy the trip.
Just like texting is sort of equivalent to Twitter is like being able to text anyone you want in the world. Anyone listening to Word of Mouth could honestly tweet at you, and if they said something that piqued your interest, you'd tweet back.
Exactly.
You know?
No.
So amazing.
It's a relationship, and that's it. You have a relationship with your learning and your cooking, and there's so many touch points. So I think it's on that note, it's at Chef Chiarello, if anybody wants to.
Exactly. You're just doing, you're like controlling the sound in this environment. You're spieling the social media, which is something I usually force people to do. Like, I'm like, and it's at LEITAHSU, at @heritage_radio, #WAMShow. So, of course, tweet at us, talk to us, and Chef Chiarella will talk back.
Absolutely. So we use Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter all for three different things, right? One's a visual, one's a short reach out. Hey. I'm doing this. Boom. And Facebook's kind of not the rest of the story. Right? I don't have enough time for blogging. Takes on forever.
Yeah. Me too. Same thing. We're the same.
And it's so people can follow along. For most of the development of what I'm doing, I don't share it all until some of it's intellectual property. But
you don't share when you're brushing your teeth.
But I think so that's what I'm doing. That's what this last month and a half has been for me, kind of going to my quiet space and quieting everything down, saying, okay, how are we going to reinvent a point of view? And looking at all the various ways that we can express our point of view, and then making sure that my team and chefs and management songs and mixologists share that same emotion and building the culture of the critical thinking path to assembling something.
Oh, that's, yep. Same, right. You know, just thinking, really just reflecting in philosophy and just really getting on the same page. I mean, you do a jillion things. You kind of just do whatever you want to. I mean, in a very wonderful way. I mean, outside of all the amazing, fun things you do, you know, you have multiple dream jobs. But outside of that, if you, let's just say, I don't know, your tongue was not as genetically attuned or something. Let's just say you weren't in food. Like, what would be your other dream job, like, outside of anything delicious?
You know, it's, I would farm.
Okay.
I would farm, and I love farming, and I farm now. But it would be a beautiful dedication, because it's a if you can't produce flavor, you can learn to grow it, and you can learn to understand what it takes to be a good steward of the land. And it's, and part of why I got out of the restaurant business in 2000, so I could do that, so I actually get the time on the track to be able to get some boots on the ground in the soil, know what it was like to convert a conventionally farmed vineyard and property into something organic, and then working through to biodynamic and actually have a point of view that you can express with knowledge, with knowingness, and not just from an academic standpoint, but from a really kind of a
visceral standpoint.
From a visceral standpoint, right? From an agribase. Saying, here's my experience with this, and it's a true experience because it's mine. It's not my opinion of how somebody's farming.
Yeah,
it's my experience of how I farm and the results I've seen from my knot hole. So it's an unarguable truth for me. And it's important to have unarguable truths in your life, so you can discuss them on your soapbox of life, be able to stand there and you can't have a whole shot through your opinion. Because it's actually based on learning.
Right. There's no holier than thou. There's like, hey, you know what? I can relate with you. I can empathize with you.
You learned it. You gotta have to learn it to earn it.
Yeah. Well, I ran into you at the James Beard Awards the whole weekend of run-ins and festivities. And you always struck me as very warm right from the start. Of course, reality TV has a certain way they like to portray people. Something that not very many people know about me is that I was cast in a reality TV pilot. And they totally took like one sentence I said and painted me as like the food and wine snob. So like,
well, that's never happened to me before. You know, it's always 100% true. I think what reality TV does is it takes... I think interesting people are an octagon.
Yeah.
And so if you begin to build your octagon...
An infinitude of the gone.
Right. So if you look at... Here's Michael Chiarella as a father, as a husband, as a mentor, as a cook, as a farmer, as a writer, as a whatever it might be. And what reality TV does is it extracts one or two or three of those. And there's emotions of how you do that in a bunch of different ways. And there's extremes of emotions. You know, I could be upset at farming, I'd be upset of whatever. I mean, there's emotions that go be super loving. Same thing with cooking. If you believe in something passionately, and it's a quest that you're on, and if something gets in the way of that quest, you either stop your quest, either go around it, mm-hmm. or over it, or through it, depending on the situation and the time and,
right.
and what it is. And you have to make a judgment. And hopefully as I've gotten older, I could decide or discern the difference.
Now, what's worth your time and energy, right?
Right. So what reality TV will do is usually pick off the ones that you go through.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And combine them with two or three other things and then spin them into whatever and then whatever. I wouldn't say they actually change or move your mouth to say a different word. But, yes, reality TV is anything but real.
I mean, in the moment, you know, did it feel hurtful or
are you talking about the Top Chef Master scene? What are you talking about?
Well, you know, I'm an odd bear in that I feel that the world of food TV is ripe for innovation. I know you feel the same way because I know that you it is something that you ponder. And so I'm not your typical watcher of food TV. However, it's weird. I read about TV more than I watch it.
Right. No, I had a couple scenes in past competition shows where it was edited slightly differently than sometimes in TV. You're trying to make a good show.
Yeah.
There was a scene where we were doing Top Chef Masters, and the segment was falling flat, and I said, well, I can help this segment out.
Oh, you were like a team player.
Yeah.
I love that. Martyr.
I could help this out, but be nice with me on it, right? So it was a scene that said, we're interviewing sous chefs, and the sous chefs for this episode were the regular Top Chef personalities, some of the kids.
Okay, yeah, I understand.
And all their
not
tattoos.
Not the masters.
So it was an interview session, and it was like, what grade were you when you finally decided you want to be a chef, and who was an inspiration in your life, and I produced enough TV to know that this thing is falling flat. So I said, if I'm going to interview somebody that I'm going to cook with for 2 hours, I kind of don't care. There's a lot of stuff I might not be as discernible about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to know, do they if they're going to be my sous chef, I'm not going to have time to teach them who I am or what I cook.
Yeah.
So first I want to know, do you know who I am? Do you know what my food is?
Yeah.
Do you have any idea of my point of view at all?
As they should. Otherwise, they're bratty millennials.
Correct. And yes. And can you be given direction while you're busy? Right. So I reset this scene to ask them to move a little bit quicker as they came up to me for the interview and go grab some onions and carrots and celery and give me a brunoise, give me a baton over there and see if they can take direction and hear some questions. You know, do you know anything about my food? Do you know anything what I've done in the past?
Yeah.
Do you know what my point of view might be? Right. Do you know who I am?
So it made them run on one of those things that
because
look
we have because you're running at breakneck
mouse
speed.
Cages.
So it's a. In a perfect world, it's everything that I would want to know if I was interviewing somebody for a 2-hour job. Right?
Absolutely.
I don't need the long story. I need the short story. I need to know these hit points.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah.
Right?
Because it's just for TV.
It's a
whatever.
2-hour show.
Yeah.
It's a 2-hour sous chef.
Fantastic.
Right?
I don't have time to say, great hiring tactics.
I've only done Thai food. I know nothing about Italian food. I have a passion for Italian food, and I've watched what
you do. Thai food chef is good for the long term, you know, to infuse your cooking with some.
It could take many, many, many years. I have 2 hours.
Yeah.
Somebody. So when it ends up being, they nail it, you know, it gets cut down to something like, do you know who I am?
Oh, man. Oh, my gosh.
So, and then that led into a manufactured but real tiff with a young chef. We actually made up on radio last month.
Oh, that's cute.
It was super sweet.
Radio is a good place to make up.
He was super sweet about it. And it was a situation that you get. You know, a chef has a place that they won't go, or they'll stop the world from going. And if you get to that place, you do it. You know what I mean?
No, I mean I know.
Don't poke the bear.
Huh. So what is that? You had a conversation where you talk about the fucked upness of this world, and I totally agree with you. And I'm that outsider insider where I'm just watching it and non-judging it, but also fascinated, but also sort of disgusted. So what is this place? First off, what is this place that chefs will and won't go? There's lots of...
Well, you have a finish line, and the finish line is the guest. The finish line is your food.
Okay.
Right, the dish. And there are places and situations where you go around, go over, and sometimes go through.
Mm-hmm.
And you go through when you decide that there's no greater good that's going to come of this until this moves out of my way.
Okay.
Right? We all learn a bunch of different ways. Sometimes you learn by nurturing soft. Sometimes you learn with noise. Sometimes you learn with... Right? People learn a bunch of different ways. Sometimes you have a little scratch in the record. Back in the day, anyway, not so much anymore. So people, if they play that song again, they don't play it the same way. You have to create behavior that everyone's breathing the same language and moving in the same direction, so you don't have any interrupt. We are cooking on a surfboard on top of a 100-foot wave.
Yeah,
right.
It is really crazy.
And the reality that nobody else sees is that if you biff, right, you go in the drink and you go deep. And you might not pop back up,
mm-hmm.
and that you can't or won't let that happen at some point.
So that's the line that you can't cross with a chef, or
there's a every chef has a place in a point of view of how we think, and you have to encourage people to be able to think in the same way. You have to teach them, and you teach the. The listening, not the listening impaired. Sometimes if somebody has a listening impairment, you have to help them too, so they can hear it better and understand what you're all about.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes some ups and downs and right different. So I'm not a screamer anymore, but I'm passionate about
anymore.
People.
Okay.
Anymore. I mean, listen, if anybody's ever done anything that they're so deeply passionate about, kind of viscerally. And that has such a high vibration in their being, that's going to create its own energy field around it. And any disruption in the energy field will kind of reverberate.
You're making me feel so much better about being myself. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. So reality TV will take whatever you might. If you met my executive sous chef, Art, I don't think I've raised my voice. I've worked with it for 6 years. I think I've raised my voice 3 times.
You have a very quietish voice.
Quietish voice, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in a noisy kitchen all the time. I like people to use their inside voices. You're 18 inches away. Are you yelling for something? Right? Because there's you have to leave.
I'm behind you.
You should feel a kitchen.
Yeah.
You should, right? You
it's like an orchestra.
Yeah. You should feel the
a rock band.
When you see salmon going up a river, they're not banging into each other. You know what the other salmon is, right? They have their own sonar.
That's cute.
They're attached to each other, right?
Yep.
And that a good kitchen goes like this. You know, there's no salmon sitting behind him. Go over there. That's my rock.
Hot behind you.
Cold
get
behind
out of my
wet
fucking
behind
way.
You. got my fin.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So the fuck no. You know, you've reached a certain level of peace. So now you have this macro view of it, and also I think you know I'm hearing sort of glimmers of you being director, producer type. Like you're sort of you've become not only the covered, but the coverer. You know, you're media. Period. And it's a fucked up world. What bothers you the most about it?
The restaurant world.
Just in general. In just general, life.
I think there's a. I think often we in the collective we. Can believe that we're born with the right to be creative.
And we're born I didn't. I'm an Asian chick. I feel. I'm serious about that. I feel.
I'm the. I'll give you an example. I get asked all the time, "Do you do any other arts? Is there anything that you do or don't do?" I says, "No, I'm waiting for that." "Well, what are you waiting for?" So, "No, what would you like to do?" I said, "I'd love to paint. I don't draw very well,
mm-hmm.
But I'd love to paint." "Well, why don't you start painting?" I said, "I haven't earned the right to paint yet." "Well, what do you mean? Just get some paint and a canvas and start painting." I said, "No, I would like to. I like to build the frames
mm-hmm.
first, and I want to stretch the canvas. I want to know the difference between each canvas. I know where they come from, where their fibers are, how they take paint in different ways, what's used for one thing versus another. That's an art inside an art. And if a frame's going to last 300 years, what do you build it out of? And how do you attach it? And why do you attach it? It's knowing the entire thing when you look at a painting, what it might be, and then the desire to make paint and understand where does pigment come from. So I'm preparing myself by just studying whatever when I find a free minute about things like that, where it might come from. What's my point of view from a pigment standpoint? If I'm such an ingredient-based chef, I would want to make my own paint.
I understand.
I want that to have some terroir attached to it, where you right. can actually see what it is and have a point of view that's consistent with other things that I do, as opposed to being off to the side and I haven't earned the right to paint yet. And when I do, I'll start painting. So I think in the world of, well, I don't need to earn the right, I'll just go to YouTube and see somebody else doing it and I'll do the same thing, and you miss having a relationship with your learning and a relationship with your food or whatever your product is in the end. Again, it's this difference between taste and flavor. If you're part of a process of something coming together, that relationship with that process, whether it's making gnocchi,
mm-hmm.
And I look at this flavor aspect this in a restaurant, their job's really for that to have really evocative emotion, the job to it, and that you're hearing the story, and it's being brought to life, and you have some relationship with the dish if you can. At least one or two of the things that you're having in a night, so to make a memory. But also having a relationship with your learning as a chef is important. I make a gnocchi ravioli here using gnocchi dough with nettles and house-made ricotta and a little duck egg and a little truffle brown butter. Now, I learned to make the called Ophelia from Lydia Bethanich. And Lydia, so I, when I make this or see it or cook it, I pay attention because I have a relationship with that dish, right? And when I eat it, I don't need three of them to be full. I have a relationship gallery. Right? And I think in our world of fucked upness, we don't have a relationship with our consumption. We don't have a relationship with our learning. But there's less of it than I'd like to see. And we don't have a relationship with our dishes. So if we're making verjus and we turn it into and we're cooking it sous vide, you have to understand all the technology behind it, mm-hmm. the fracturing temperature of an alcohol, what are the volatile flavors of the grape and the wine, how do you do the acid, and how are we going to express that in a drink? I want somebody to be able to taste something. Here's what's going on in the vineyard right now in this cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Here's variation of why it's really important. So go away. It's hard. You hand somebody an unripe grape, it tastes like nothing. Or they don't understand. No, here's the ritual, here's the understanding. And then every cook will look. People will come through and cook years, and they won't step foot in a vineyard or on a crush pad. They don't have to learn how to make wine. But you it's nice to be able to be in sync with where you're at.
Yep.
And to know what's going on. If I can tell that story to a visitor or a local, if here's what's going on in my vineyards right now, expressed in a dessert, on a lamb dish, so we use the leaves, we use the cuttings to make an ash, to make a glaze for a piece of pottery, right? So we'll look at sustainability in a much different way. And again, if it's having a relationship with that food, if you look at calories. In a world of, you know, in a Western world of 680 million overnourished, I'm not the guy that's going to write the treadmill program. But I am the guy to say I believe in my heart of hearts that relationship calories are missing, and that if you begin to have a relationship with your food, then the quantity of that dish that you need to be full, to be sated, is less. Because you have these emotional qualities that you're consuming. The relationship back into what we eat, I believe deeply, passionately, that you don't need the quantity and it will self-correct itself and you'll be more happy and healthy and wholesome.
Conscientiousness and relationships.
Conscientious consumption.
And connecting. And yesterday I had such a mind-blowing meal solo at the bar at Bar Tartine.
Uh-huh.
And the cherry on top was peach leaf tea that, goodness gracious, it tastes like marzipan, like almondness, and you pour some milk in it. It tastes like the Taiwanese, the almond jello
stuff. I can't believe you just said that. I spent the last 2 weeks on expressing just the leaves. Leaves are the memory that you have of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? I did Sophia Loren's 80th birthday party at Farniente a couple weeks ago. And one of,
wow.
One of the classes we did were, and she's from Napoli.
That's so cool.
and we did a tomato water spaghetti, this pasta Gragnano from a little village next to where she grew up, a really special pasta. But it was pasta that was hydrated and cooked in the water of the tomato. without any of the solids.
And
the water finished, we finished it with the tomato leaf. And so you got a horizontal flavor. And it needed nothing. It had a little bit of an aromatic oil.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the guest took a tomato leaf in the fork hand and rubbed it, you know.
Really? So you had all the guests do that?
Right. So when you if you've ever picked tomatoes and walk back into the house into a cool environment and you smell your arm, it's the smell of the leaf. So the smell of the memory of picking a tomato is in the leaf. It's not in the tomato.
My gosh, that's so lovely. And with peaches, it's even more interesting because the peach pit is an almond.
Exactly. We do fig leaf gelato here that changed your life.
Here.
Yeah. I don't know if we have it now.
I might have to stay until 5:30.
So if I'm working on a cocktail, it's the same thing. I'm doing kind of a fig and prosciutto cocktail and a little crispy piece of that.
Fig and prosciutto cocktail?
Yeah, it's really great.
That is very fun.
But the fig leaf in that, in it with the fig, with the fruit is the whole thing. So you remembered this because of the peach leaf and the emotion that it had with it, right?
It tastes like the Taiwanese almond jello. You know the white stuff? You've had that before, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So you had a relationship with that flavor, and leaves are super special that way.
And nobody, I mean, at least, you know, of course, being a self-centered New York asshole, I'm like, oh, well, what's different about this place? You know, so I'm like, you know, peach leaves, there's not one restaurant in New York that does a whole lot with leaves, FYI, so.
Well, you just saw my Cabernet that we're making into a vodka, and there were leaves inside there.
A Cabernet that you're making
you're right.
Into a vodka. Is that the stuff? So you just bought a bag of...
A little vacuum-packed bag of grapes.
And grapes and leaves.
And the grapes were and leaves juice. And some juice, and we're making an infusion at a particular temperature and length of time. And the leaves are part of it.
So what is that turning into? Because...
This, a time and place cocktail for Bottega. Here's a cocktail that represents exactly what's going on in the vineyard right now.
That's
here's
so fun.
Taste. Here's
okay.
Your smell.
Okay.
Right. If you were me, if you have 20 acres.
If you were me.
Or if you were a farmer. If you
I
were,
understand.
If, right.
So what's going to happen? So you took leaves and juice and grapes,
and an alcohol.
Those are Cabernet grapes. Cabernet.
Yeah, the Cabernet from our best Cabernet.
And what's going to happen?
Well, now you want the whole thing. You have to come and see. We infuse them all together in alcohol, and that alcohol is going to turn into a cocktail. I haven't made the final cocktail yet. I don't really think about what I'm thinking about. I stay in it. I say, okay. And then I build it. Now, what do we want to do with it? Right. So I want to see it in a bourbon. I want to see it in a whiskey. I want to see it in a vodka. I want to see it in a tincture. I want to see it in a vermouth.
Okay.
I want to see it, right? I want to see it as a syrup. I want to, right? There's a bunch of different ways that I can use it. I want to see it as a juice. Not just the juice by itself.
So we shall see.
And the ingredient will tell you how it wants to be, because the flavors are oil-soluble, water-soluble, volatile aromas, sometimes oils in a water, like a hydrosol.
I have to admit that I didn't expect or think that you, just not because you're an Italian chef, but just that I didn't realize that you had all this science-y, mad science kind of stuff.
You want to know how an ingredient wants to be used, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating, and it's exactly what a chef would do. When do you add rosemary to a dish? Well, that's different during the time of year. So if you farm or you garden, you'll know that it takes 3 months in the winter for rosemary to grow half an inch. It takes 3 hours in the summer.
Wow!
So the same amount of oleoresins are present in half an inch to 3 inches or 4 inches.
That's amazing.
So you have to be conscious of what's going on, so you have to know how to use your ingredient. And it wants to be expressed in different ways. So I use rosemary different in the winter than I do in the summer, than I do in the spring, than I do in the fall.
So I know your mom passed some time ago from cancer. Mm-hmm. And I know she had an opportunity to witness some of the delicious creations that you put out in the world. So, I mean, what would she say now about all of this mad scientist stuff, and just that you've reached this like kind of ridiculous outlier level of success?
I'm actually less concerned about the success on the outside, more concerned about the success on the inside. It's why I don't do some things, right? It's why I'm just doing everything I can to quiet my world down. It took us 6 months to get this interview, right? And I had to fit into my day, right? And,
yeah.
And if I had a choice between, I left something I'm deeply passionate about to come down here, and I'm going to go back and finish it. Right? So if I went all the way to San Francisco, I would have lost an entire day. And at some point, you put a collection of those days together and you never, ever get them back.
Right.
So the she'd be proud that I'm holding my ground, my feet on the ground, to get back to the things that give me most pleasure, and to make conscious decisions about who I am as a father, as a husband, as a boss, as my own spiritual development, emotional development, and a chef. But she had a super scientific mind.
She really?
Was always working experiments and bits and pieces, whatever this. I got it from her. My oldest brother is a scientist. He was a DNA scientist before he retired.
What kind of scientist?
DNA? DNA?
Oh, DNA, okay.
Yeah. So he would...
Really?
With life score.
This is... You guys do kind of the same thing, but just one
exactly.
is edible.
Exactly. So I think understanding what things happen and why... I think the technology is important. For us, what we say here is technology are the cymbals on a drum set.
Yeah.
And if you hear the cymbals too often, if you hear the cymbals, you're playing them too loud. For me. I think it should be a happy surprise inside. It should be a happy surprise inside what we're doing. So
families.
So I think the yes, you know, TV's an amazing... An amazing way to express what you've known already.
Really? What do you mean by that?
Well, it's like writing a book, only better, because you take something you've learned, you can share it with somebody. If you write a recipe, it's one dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
If you write it really well, it's two dimensional. If you write the headers and the footers, then maybe somebody can feel it. But if you can have that and watch me make it and hear from my heart where it came from. Understand the emotion behind that dish, then you can really understand it. So you take a period of your life and you learn a bunch of stuff, then you begin to write about it, and then you talk about it on TV. And cooking on TV has gone to the wayside. Nobody wants to.
Oh, yeah. It's a dump and stir.
Nobody wants to do any dump and stirs. Nobody producing television or airing television wants to teach anybody how to cook anymore. They want to get entertainment.
Yep. It's not actually the teaching that David Rosengarten did. It's just the like, blah, 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 everyone, you know, competing, and it's like a spectacle.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Turning the volume up as opposed to turning the volume down.
So, what's next for Food TV?
For me?
For you in general. What do you want to see? Like, what are you craving?
I don't want to stop my learning to teach, if that makes sense. I want to teach as I'm learning.
Yep.
So if I can figure out a way to share as I go, right, then I can actually accomplish what I want to with my craft. But I don't want to be 75 and grumpy and say, yeah, I did that kind of organic dog food brand, and that was cool, and I made some money doing that, and yeah, then I did that Chrysler piece, and I traveled around Chrysler around the world, and I designed their steering wheels made out of, you know, edible eggshells or something, so you feel like you're in the barn, or whatever it might be.
Did you just make all this up, or is this, okay, yeah, I was like, wait a minute, what?
What's random things that come along in your life, so when you're gathering up your career, not about what you done, but who you've become and what you've learned, will I be happy with what I've done? And
I think it's really the paying it close attention, sensing when you're truly excited about something instead of kind of just doing stuff.
Correct. So if you, I get asked all the time, why don't you do a book on this? Do a Coquetta book. I'm going to do a Coquetta book. I'm just, I haven't learned enough to write about it yet.
Yeah.
I'm only 4 years into cooking Spanish food. And I don't have a consistent point of view enough of making something for the sake of doing it. And it would just stop my life for a year. You know, stop the development of what I'm doing there. I would rather do a book on 2.0 and come with me as I look at reinventing what I've already known.
Yep.
That way we both learn at the same time. Because you're either talking... Media is often about talking about what you've already learned behind you. Do you understand that?
Absolutely. speaking of reinventing, how did you meet your wife?
That's a great reinvention. we met when I was starting Apostyle. I had a specialty foods business, and I'm not a particular huge fan of the 3-tier system of I produce a product as an artist and producer, and then it goes to a broker and a distributor, and then the retailer in the end, and then a customer in the end. Mm-hmm. The two people that should benefit most from that should be the customer and the artisan. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that generally benefit the least. So if we can create a direct consumer, I'll make something and sell to you, then we can make better stuff at higher quality, charge a little bit less. Because there's so many things you can't do, because it'll end up being $28 on the shelf by the time you pass it through everything. Mm-hmm. But maybe if it was $18 on the shelf and you do something exquisite, more like it is in Europe, we can have better stuff.
Right.
And if the home cook could start with better stuff and have a relationship with who the producer was and why it was done. So we started Apostyle, and that was an interesting time when I was doing a bunch of TV and doing Apostyle and designing product.
Right.
And if you design a table or a chair, like this chair I'm sitting in, it's supposed to do this, right? This chair was designed to do what my arm's doing now. Mm-hmm. At the end of a meal, to push back, cross my legs, put my arm over, and feel absolutely comfortable. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, this is more of a guy's move.
I'm pretty good at it, too.
Right? And it's a queen chair. It's a Cuisinart chair. It's a redo of a chair that has a place, but it's a very thin, narrow. It's more of a woman's chair, how it was designed. This is designed for something else. So the idea is a chair should do more than hold your ass. Mm-hmm. Right? And in a world where if you got knocked out or you're in a coma for a week and you woke up and you were a little dizzy and you looked at your apartment, I would hate it if people thought that it looked like a Pottery Barn bomb blew up in their apartment. Like they're animals for adults, that you know there's no pieces that have any they have a relationship or story with. So I think it's important. So I think you have to make the pause points in your life to do these things that are really important. And then go back to the source, right?
So then you did Apostyle, but how did you meet your wife?
We were just starting Apostyle. Oh. She just came out of Apple.
Apple, okay.
She's
so interesting.
Mm-hmm. She's forgotten more than I know about anything. And I hired her as a contractor. We met at a conference, and some of her clients she was consulting with are really interesting. It was a company about doing, it was kind of a just add credit card solution to urban gardening.
Right.
So every stoop or fire escape you had, so there were these regional gardens that were plugged in. So whatever it was, you could still have this feeling. And I loved it. And it wasn't getting the traction that it should have at the conference, so I kind of got behind it. Mm-hmm. And I met her and found
it. So to help people with urban gardens sell stuff.
Make stuff for themselves, whatever it is, whatever. It's called Window. A company called it's called Windowbox. Windowbox.com. It's a cool company. It still exists. It's about bringing, you know, it's having that. Whether you're in New York and you have X number of months a year that you have your window box, right? And you can see it every morning, right? And kind of nurturing yourself. So I love what it did, and I love what she had to say about it. So we met, and I hired her to help me with Apostyle, and we fell head over heels in love, and we've been doing things together ever since. She's helped me with everything I've done since, and. So we did Apostyle together for a bunch of years and jumped into my media and ran marketing for my various businesses and, mm-hmm. and let me get back into the restaurant business when I couldn't take it anymore.
Right.
And now I have a chance to support her. She's just started a company called Barn Raiser. It's called Barn
Raiser
in the U.S. And it's a crowdfunding company for the clean and sustainable food and farming and home farming movement.
So how's that going? I you mentioned it to me months ago, and then I wanted to share it with everybody and give us the update.
It's spectacular. You know, it's for me, I can only affect the change in what I touch with my own finger. Mm-hmm. Most part. The change I make is slow. It has to go through somebody. Maybe they begin to affect some change. This is bringing funds, marketing, and a community. To the change makers. If you want to change the world and say, okay, here's this big fire, this inferno that's going on. There's not enough water in the world to put out that inferno. The mm-hmm. only way you can attack that fire is to build a series of backfires.
Yep.
And those backfires suck the oxygen out of the main fire. So and you're never going to put the water on it. You're going to get rid of the source of it. Does that make sense?
Right. Well,
so barn raising does that. It creates all these brush fires in and around this.
Tiny steps, yep.
In and around. So it's funding and bringing to life and actualizing all of these other things in and around. Because we realize, and she realized, that change is too slow. And we have to speed the change up. And we don't have enough water to put it out.
Mm-hmm. By not just the funding, but the storytelling and then sort of having her marketing savvy and then your audience, you know, combine that. It can be a very powerful thing. I mean, I guess my one startup-y tech-minded question is that something like Kickstarter has an audience, you know, has sort of the, it's like the watering hole of crowdfunding. What are the benefits of Barnraiser?
Well, it's the same thing of any. It's living in a city versus being in a community. You live in New York, you live in a city. You live in I think New York's fantastic. New York is the Kickstarter.
Yep, and it's a small town of Chinatown or of Williamsburg or Upper East Side.
So what Barnraiser is the neighborhood.
Absolutely.
Of like-minded people. So the conversations you have are easy, and the people are able to see different things, right? So Barnraiser does to pull together a larger and larger growing community of like-minded people that want to affect change. Other consumers and passionate people that are interested in that. They're not interested in I love Kickstarter to death. I just bought a circulator.
Right.
From Kickstarter program.
Oh, Nomiku?
Yeah.
I know those guys.
It's great. Just arrived. I just have a startup in my kitchen right now.
That's incredible. Lisa Fetterman. They actually came on the show. And
Tell them I love it.
Okay. She's going to be so excited to hear it. I mean, she probably knows that you bought it, but you know.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure your name pops up. And it's like fairly obvious.
So I think, again, with gathering that up will really help, and it will help begin to build a marketplace as well.
I'm gonna talk to her. Yeah, that's rad what she's doing.
Super good.
I have two last questions for you, and then we're gonna do a little wind it down with the wine that we're tasting.
Damn it.
Okay, so you talked about the inside and outside lives of and minds of chefs. Can you know, I've gotten to know some chefs that I've never had someone explain it that way before. And what do you mean by that?
From the inside or the outside of who are we on the inside? What do we see on the outside? What is this?
Just the, you know, that inside is actually not so zany and outside is can be pretty gnarly.
It's your happy place, right? It's food. It's what you're doing. And in this, everybody loves to just talk about what are you on the outside, kind of this irreverent beast that beating the drum.
It's pretty beastly. Beastial.
Without bestiality. And everything, all the angst that we have is everything that's trying to tear away from the fabric of that sweet thing that you have in the middle of you, right? The burning desire is to do this, and you fight it. And you fight the commercialism, you fight whatever it might be, and it comes out, right? It's no different than a parent about a child, right? You know, attack a parent's child and see who they really are really quick.
Okay.
Right? Right, so
I've seen that before.
It's the response that you have with, and it's one of my children.
It's when you care too much.
There's nothing that you wouldn't do to protect your child.
Yeah,
and it's that same place for a chef. That's
where the angst comes from.
The angst comes
goodness
from,
gracious,
right?
Yep.
Right, don't poke the bear. This thing. This is precious, and only you see it. And sometimes other people see it as well. But you're protecting this thing that nobody else can see, and they can't figure out why you're so anxious about something. Because you see what happens 3 years from now. That slippery slope, I might say, as the kitchen mat goes, mm-hmm. and how it's clean it is, how it's organized in the kitchen, as goes the rest of the restaurant. If you can't pay attention to this, if you're dirty and your station's dirty and you're not organized, if you're a windmill in the kitchen, you can never learn to feel.
I don't want you to see my home kitchen.
Right? Whatever it might be.
But yes.
So that makes sense. So what we see in the media, I don't have big anxious days, but I am passionate about what I do, and if everybody's passionate at the same time, then. The noise can come down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is consistent and even, as opposed to, and if nobody else, if the rest of your team doesn't, then you have to bring the volume up on yourself.
Well, you have the perspective now, having been in the media for how many years?
I don't want to say.
Okay. some
98,
number 98, of 98, 98 like
a long time
with that perspective, that actually is leads me to my last question, which is that you're a fellow who went from chefing to media back to chefing, and then I mean, I guess this is a two-pronged question. How does it feel to why the phases, like how does that feel, and then what's like you could do whatever you want, and you've done so much, like what is this all, what's the end result, like what's the goal? I mean,
well, the journey is the destination, so it's to get back on the journey of developing your point of view and whatever it is, whatever critical thinking path you have. You say, okay, finally, you know, at 50, we're going to say, okay, I just started to get good. I just started to get good at this. And
wow.
Before Robert Mondavi passed, he pulled me aside, and his dear friend, and said, remember, I started Mondavi Winery at 50. Everything up until
really?
That point, everything up until that point was getting me prepared for that.
That's wonderful.
So
then
the exact
moment that you realize you need to get back in the kitchen.
Oh, that was a very specific. I had a nightmare. It was,
what?
I had a nightmare, a horrible nightmare. And I just had a job. And it was eight now, so it was eight and a half. So I had a nightmare. I was the CEO at Napstyle, my retail and catalog business. And I had a nightmare that I hit by a bus. It was his first day at kindergarten, and he was walking up with Eileen, my wife, and they're holding hands, and he's got his little lunch bag, whatever, and he goes in kindergarten. And I got hit by a bus.
I did.
I got hit by a bus. So I was dead. I wasn't there. And he goes in the kindergarten, they're sitting in the circle time or whatever, and I said, okay, who are your parents? Where are they from? Oh, no, my papa's dead. He got hit by a bus. And I said, well, yeah, I'm so sorry to hear that, but what did he do? Who was he? He says, well, he was a... And when this came out in slow motion, when he said CEO, it came out like CEO. I woke up in a cold sweat. I'm like,
oh my
fuck!
God.
I'm not going to get hit by a bus. I'm not going to have my children be that their last thought of me is that I was a CEO. It's the last thing in the plan I would ever want. Yes, I'm running this business, but no, who am I? If I were to get hit by a bus, what would I want him to know me as? You know, would I have the face of my family, or would I just have the face of the CEO? I can't do it. So over the next couple months, it grew, that desire and passion. Finally, I told my board, I'll keep working on this, but I gotta get back in here. I've used all the ideas that I've developed already. I've expressed them in every way that I can, from television to products to retail to wine to what, all these different places. I wanna farm. I wanna farm. I wanna do Napstyle. I wanna be attuned to what's going on the farm. I want to do Napstyle as a startup, so I can do my farming, and I can do Napstyle in the middle of the night.
Right.
Whatever's in the startup, and I can develop my media. And when I got done with all that, I said, now I need to go back to learning again.
A student and a chef.
Student and chef, right.
Right. Wow, okay.
I'm humbled once again.
Being hit by a bus is definitely it's like a thing that people joke about, and it's kind of your nightmare. There's a movie. There's a movie here. Who's gonna play you in your movie?
I think it's the quest of every chef, right? It's the fight. It's the turmoil inside us about who are you versus what are you.
Not just chef, but human being who reflects.
Yeah, maybe.
So at the end of the show, we always take a couple minutes to talk about what we're drinking here.
Oh, this is fun. So Kirell Family Vineyards was a... Not because I want to... Don't ever get in the wine business. It's a horrible business model.
Terrible.
It was a chance for me to really understand the plight of the farmer and to know it emotionally, but also do some fun stuff. So this is the first wine we're tasting. It's a Chiara Bianca. Chiara is what I would have been called if I came at a girl. So it's the more feminine side of our brand, and we do a rosé, and we do this wine. It's the only grape I don't farm. This is a George Varr, this farmer of viticulturist. He passed away this year, which is unfortunate. This is a grape called Ribolla Gialla.
Mm-hmm.
It's a grape from Friuli.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfiltered, as you can see. This year was in particular because it was a lighter year. the white wine made like a red wine.
Yep.
So good skin contact.
Yep.
I guess about, this got about 26 days of skin contact. So it has, it doesn't have barrel tannin, but it has finger tannin.
Absolutely.
And you never see tannin in a white wine. You never taste
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. It just really sort of, it's just like kind of like velvety in just the right way. And it's just, it's great acidity on both of these.
Something
actually.
Bright. It's a beautiful food wine. So we only did a couple hundred cases. And it really was a white wine that you drink through two courses. Because you can drink this with a pasta, no problem. You can do this with light red meats, no problem. You can have a light bolognese, kind of a springy, summery bolognese, because mm-hmm. it's got some stuffing because of the skin contact.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you don't want to have three wines at dinner. You don't want to have a Sauvignon or something to start and then go to a Zinfandel and go to a Cabernet. Sometimes you want one that can travel. So it's a beautiful wine for that. It's not one I would ever put in distribution. We just sell at the restaurants and at the winery. But I love it to death.
I love it. It's just, I've been guzzling that.
The other, this is a wine called Bambino.
Mm-hmm.
It's named after my son. And this is Budwood given me by Andrei Talachev. Andrei's the founding father of American viticulture, and I had the pleasure of working with him. He's at BV, Beaulieu Vineyards, since 1936. Mm-hmm. He's unfortunately passed a bunch of years ago. But when he came out of retirement, he went back and BV hired him to consult and help them with their wine program again. He asked me to come and do the food part of that with them. And I said, sure, as long as you teach me the great part of this, the fun part of this. So respect.
That was chef and TV personality Michael Chiarello of restaurants Bottega in Napa Valley and Coqueta in San Francisco on Word of Mouth, one of our SF sessions on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyte Sue, and thank you so much for joining us today. Next Wednesday, 2 p.m. Eastern, we'll welcome Mark Rosati, head chef of the 50-some beloved Shake Shacks all around the world. Until then, have a listen to your dreams, eat well, and be swell.
Today's show is brought to you by Of A Kind.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.